Hi, everyone, and welcome to ForageCast, a podcast from Forage Genetics. Each month, we take a deep dive into alfalfa topics and address real on-farm issues that revolve around alfalfa's integration into cropping systems. And now, here's your host, Emily Message.
Welcome to this episode of ForageCast, sponsored by Forage Genetics International. I'm Dr. Emily Message, Technical Support Specialist with FGI. Today, we're fortunate to be joined by Dr. Jennifer Tucker, Assistant Professor of Beef Nutrition and Forage Management in the Animal and Dairy Science Department at the University of Georgia. Dr. Tucker's research interest evaluates the influence of forage quality and management on beef nutrition and production in the southeastern U.S. She is part of many collaborative extension and research efforts, working with university faculty across the U.S., as well as within the USDA ARS system. She has developed a nationally recognized research and extension program, graduating many top caliber graduate students in beef and forage systems management programs. Jennifer, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk.
Me too. I always get excited to talk to somebody about alfalfa, especially in an area of the country that we really don't commonly associate alfalfa with. So what got you and your group interested in doing more work with alfalfa in the South?
Well, originally, I'm from Kentucky, so growing up with alfalfa and alfalfa production was kind of one of those standard things. Actually, my dad holds the record for the most pounds of beef produced in the state of Kentucky. When I came to Georgia, Dr. Dennis Hancock was here as a forage specialist, and there was a lot of work that was going on from demonstrations utilizing alfalfa, but not a lot of active research. And so I saw a niche and a market that really these producers in the Southeast could definitely benefit from, and figured, you know, why not? Everybody says it won't work, so why not see if it will?
Now, you mentioned that you've heard a lot of people say alfalfa just doesn't work in the South. And I've heard the same thing. You know, they point out the low pH soils, the issues with disease and pests and that sort of thing. What do you say to that? What's your response to people that are leery of growing alfalfa in the South?
So starting out, I had, I guess, some of those same concerns. I actually had faculty members in other areas that said, that just doesn't work here. Why are you trying to do that? And of course, research. If we knew all the answers, they'd just call it search. So that's why it's research. And I saw this as a challenge, and I didn't think that it couldn't be done. Having, I guess, Joe Boughton and Don Ball and some of these great Southeastern predecessors whose forage just I don't even know what the word is, but they're just amazing to work with, you know, and they never said it wouldn't work. And so if they're not saying it won't work, then there's got to be a reason. And so I really just saw that there was an opportunity, and why not? Why not just see if it'll work? Now, when I talk with producers, I can kind of take them out into the field, or I use social media and I show them that, you know, it does work. And we have some we've abused, and we have some that, you know, we have treated with the absolute best care, and it's here in both aspects. So really, I've gone with the seeing is believing approach. And now I have the ability, when I talk to producers, to not only say, I know this research has happened, but I myself have done it. So when there's challenges, you know, I have faced those challenges, and this is how we've overcame those. And I think that having that visual demonstration and research that, you know, you can take and actually tangible, you know, touch that has really helped a lot of our producers to jump past that hesitation and jump out and try it on their own.
1,000%. You know, I think that it's one thing to show some pictures from a research project in a PowerPoint presentation or a video or something like that, but having the ability to actually bring the producers on farm into the field and be in front of that is so critical to success. And one of the things that I love about your program and what you and your collaborators at the other universities are doing is that you have these programs where not only do you have your field demonstrations, but you're doing on-farm trials as well. Because that's always one of the biggest things that I remember when I was in extension and research. You know, you have people that say, well, yeah, it works in a research environment. Does it actually work in the field? Would it work on my own ranch? And so you guys are doing some of those programs to support that on-farm research. Can you talk a little bit? Let's start with your Got Bermuda Grass program. Talk to me about how that got started and where that's headed.
So about 15 years ago, so obviously not when I was here, but the GAP Bermuda grass program really jumped off. Dr. Joe Boughton was actually looking at production of Bermuda grass in our region. And when you line up the soil test requirements for hybrid Bermuda grass and the soil test requirements for alfalfa, the nutrient requirements essentially the same, with the exception of that nitrogen component. You know, you still need to put those high amounts of potash and make sure your phosphorus is where it's at and, you know, bump that pH a little bit, but it really marries well. And as I like to tell people, we took the king of Bermuda grass and the queen of forages, and we just created the perfect union there with our mixtures now. So the work that they started about 15 years ago was really trying to work with some of these producers that were, how do they improve their Bermuda grass? What can we do better? And started on farm. And then we translated that into getting some more in-depth research here at the research station when I started in 2016. So from the GAP Bermuda grass program, we've established multiple on-farm demonstration locations across the Southeast. Obviously, several of those are in Georgia because it kind of started in Georgia, but we now have some in Florida and Alabama, and really trying to bring in more researchers in different soil environments, because there's lots of different soils that are throughout the southeastern area. And then we've also collaborated that with the Alfalfa in the South production workshops, which Dennis Hancock started. And now we've continued that research and extension education effort. And so that is a really good way to get producers on those demonstration and production farms, because we collaborate those meetings with those producers. And so then you're not asking just us as a researcher or a specialist or a plant breeder or even an industry person. You know, everybody stands out in this field and looks at this guy's alfalfa, and then just the questions start flowing. So I really enjoy that part.
Well, and I love it too, because you've got that producer involvement, you've got the producer ownership even, you know, they've been a part of this. And so they're excited to talk about it and they're excited to tell their neighbors. And so that just helps, you know, generate more and more excitement and hopefully more adoption of this too. And so with these programs, you're actually looking at how to successfully interseed alfalfa into generally Bermuda grass, might be some other warm season like Bahia grass even too, but to help improve the quality, right?
Right.
And what, so for those of you that are listening that are maybe more familiar with our cool season grass counterparts, you know, how is our warm season grasses like Bermuda grass and Bahia grass, how are they going to be a little bit different? And why do we want to be even considering including alfalfa into those mixes?
So when we look at our warm season perennial base, our quality of forage is moderate at best, even with those top quality or those top yielding Tipton 85 Bermuda grass. And it's got good quality, but can we bump that? Can we improve that performance on that same unit of land? And we took the idea of interseeding cool season grasses, because we don't have a lot of cool season perennials, especially as far south as we are in Tipton. And so a common practice is to overseed dormant Bermuda grass sods with cool season grasses like annual ryegrass or rye, or maybe a crimson clover, or add some type of legume. And so we took that same management of mowing, spraying, and planting, and then we just implemented a perennial legume. It just seemed, because the growth of that legume, when you establish it in the fall, has all winter to get that root development and really get in there going to allow it to compete once that Bermuda grass breaks dormancy. And so it really starts to create that cycle that you're looking for to extend the use of that land from essentially 4 months to up to 7, or maybe even year round, depending on the weather that year. So we're seeing some really interesting results there. Some of the other challenges that I've seen, obviously growing up and being in tall fescue country, and we actually have a project where we're establishing alfalfa into fescue as well as into Bermuda to kind of compare those and look at times of year. And I'm actually having a greater challenge if you have a strong tall fescue stand to get that alfalfa established. Those are better established together, whereas in a Bermuda grass or Bahia grass system, you want to establish those separately. Mm-hmm. And it's that dormancy period of that warm season that matches really well with the cool season alfalfa coming in. And so we found some interesting things, you know, just pulling from other data, but it works out really well. And you're that quality, those numbers, you know, we get on average a 20 crude protein on alfalfa Bermuda grass mixes, and you're just not going to get that on any of your warm season perennials. And so if you can improve that nutrition plane, now we can start having conversations about sustainability or improved grass-fed production in a part of the country that how are you going to do grass-fed if you can't produce grass? Well, down here, we're green pretty much all year. So add a few components in there, and now we've actually upped that game. And so it really fits really nice into that.
But so the way you guys are using this then is it's a grazing system. And so you're planting it so that the alfalfa is going to be dominant in certain parts of the year, typically obviously the cooler parts. And then your warm season grass would kind of take over then in the summer months. And are you seeing any sort of issues with animal performance, with bloat? I know that's always a concern with grazing alfalfa. What kind of are your learnings there?
Well, so our original work, we actually were doing with baleage production because we have, you know, you can get 7 to 8 harvests across the year on this. Well, this time of year, you know, in the spring, rain is almost a guarantee. And so you're not going to get that 2 to 3 day window to make a dry hay product. And of course, we know with alfalfa production, the longer you let it dry, the more times you're in that field, the more leaf loss. So moving into a baleage system really fits well with being able to maintain that quality as well as hold on to that leaf. And so we found that that was a really good mix. Well, we also tracked what our alfalfa and Bermuda grass components were doing across the season. And what you really see is an ebb and flow relationship. And so early in the season, you're going to get that dominant alfalfa those first two cuttings or those first 2 months. Starting into that June, July, and summertime period, you start to see that Bermuda grass get more dominant in that stand. August, you know, July, August is when we get that stress on alfalfa. And so it's not really, it's there, but it's not having this big contribution. But then you start back in the fall and here you see this greening of the alfalfa while your Bermuda grass is shutting down. And so we really get that ebb and flow. And we have, you know, the data that really illustrates that as you see kind of the components just change, but it works very well together. We also figured out that planting space, row space really has an effect. And so I guess it's twofold benefit for producers considering a system like this because you're planting either double the acreage or half the seed because we use a 14-inch row spacing rather than a 7-inch row spacing when we interseed so that we actually have that Bermuda grass component. You know, our goal is not to shade out either one of these, but to create a complementary system, not a competitive system. And so on a 14-inch row spacing, we see that your alfalfa gets what it needs to survive and the Bermuda grass still gets enough sunlight. When you go to 7 inches, you shade out your Bermuda. So you start getting other weeds or other forages potentially in that system. When you go to a 20 inch or a wider inch than 14 or 15, depending on what that middle one is, but you get much wider than that. And now your Bermuda grass is so strong that the alfalfa just can't outcompete that because it's gotten so much more Bermuda grass in the system. From a grazing point, because now we moved from our baleage work into grazing work, and now we actually have a multi-use system. So we are evaluating baleage production only next to grazing, next to a cut and graze or dual use system where you would cut it early in the season, get those higher quality cuts. Then you start to graze, you pull off during that stress period of July, August, and then you go back and you graze a stockpiled option. Now, we call it stockpile, but we're not guaranteed a frost down here. So it's you know, more of a deferred grazing, but you're allowing that Bermuda grass to get through, or that alfalfa to get through that stress. And still, you can stockpile that Bermuda grass for grazing later in the year when everything else would be going dormant. And the system seems to be working. We've already done a full year of data collection comparing all three of those, and we're starting year two. We actually did our first cut last week, and so we'll be grazing really soon. From an animal performance standpoint, I know a lot of people are concerned about bloat. We do provide a mineral that has rumensin in it or a bloat blocker, you know, because you don't want to be the researcher that killed some animals. But we have seen that in these systems where you have the grass component, because even in the springtime period, we're going to have some ryegrass that's contributing. You know, you control your management. You don't put them on in the morning when it's wet. But we've had no issues with bloat, even in situations where they may have gotten into the field without having that rumensin in their system. And I think that's because you're not getting a pure stand. And so your concern for bloat definitely decreases because you had that grass component to kind of break that up in their system. So what we're seeing on animal performance, we're using fall born steers, and we're really starting out just looking at the growth parameters. You know, how do we get more weight on these animals in the hot summer months? And we kind of see again the ebb and flow in their weight gain as the same as we see in the ebb and flow of the alfalfa component in the system. We did an evaluation a few years ago where we evaluated Bermuda grass with nitrogen, Bermuda grass without nitrogen, and the Bermuda grass with alfalfa. And you see that at a stocking density, you get a higher stocking density with that mixture than you do with the pure stand. You obviously got higher performance out of that pure stand with the nitrogen or the alfalfa than you did with the one without nitrogen. Although we did have a lot of crabgrass that came into that one because there wasn't anything else there. And crabgrass is a great forage. So you didn't see these huge weight differences. But the other thing we're kind of noticing is you're still getting good gains, but in that summer when everything's stressed and it gets so hot, I don't know that alfalfa is what you want to graze in August. Why not make, you know, protect that forage during August, pull off of it, go to your dominant Bermuda or Bahia or whatever it is for that month, and then save that for that later time period. So now you're getting the best of both. And you're not really going to see a drop in your animal performance if you pull off your, because everything's so stressed out. I think I'm the only thing that can gain weight in August. I'm pretty sure.
I don't know. After COVID, I'm pretty sure all of us can probably say that. So.
That is true.
So this is where, you know, successful rotational grazing management, that's really going to come into play to make sure that your alfalfa has the ability to persist. Are you seeing any issues with persistence if it's appropriately managed, though?
So what we actually have is in our early grazing of our project, we are doing a 7-day rotation. The first project we did a few years ago, we had 3 splits. So we took 2 acres and we split them into 3 equal parts. And we would graze each section for 7 days. So it was a 21-day rotation of rest. The first year, we had plenty of rain, so we didn't have any problems. But the second year, we got into a severe drought. And having that lesser, only that 21 days of rest really had an impact on certain sections of grazing. So if we got a little bit of rain, then that, you know, little strip would be okay. But if you didn't get any rain by 21 days, we would have to be ending the study because there wouldn't be anything there, you know, visibly. Now, surprisingly, even after we grazed it a little harder than we wanted, when we came back, there was still alfalfa there. It was very interesting to see the next season that this stuff came back because we thought we'd just decimated it. So in this next study, we actually did an evaluation in between where we looked at harvest height and harvest frequency to kind of figure out what that target ideal area is going to be for making grazing recommendations. And so from this data, we did figure out that at 4-week rotation and about a 4-inch height, you don't want to go lower than that. And you don't want to go higher than that because we did do a 6-week and a 6-inch height. And you had the same effect and just kind of like same idea of overgrazing and undergrazing can have the same impact on quality. We saw that same effect on quality and persistence because you do get shading problems for that younger material that's underneath. You need to kind of remove that off, especially with the alfalfas that we're using because they already start regrowth. It's really interesting when we cut these varieties because we work with the dormancy of it. So it's almost a semi to a non-dormant variety. And so we can mow these or graze these and you can go out in the field the day that you're cutting it and already see little green leaves and tillering and all this happening. Like it's just, it's coming. It's already regrowing. It's so interesting to see that. Well, if you wait 6 weeks, what have you done on that new growth that's trying to get to the sunlight? Well, you have shaded that out. So we went with the 4-week, 4-inch target. And so on this evaluation, we actually are grazing 7 days with at least a 28-day rest.
And so with all the successes that you're having with the research and obviously kind of circling around to what we talked about with wanting to have that on-farm data as well, are producers having the same success with being able to whether they're doing baleage or whether they're grazing, keeping that alfalfa in for multiple years, having a decent persistence on it? Is that working for them?
So it really depends on the use. We actually kind of target different producers that are using it different ways so that we can kind of get a baseline of what our expectations should be. I actually have a producer that is a grass-fed producer, and he adds alfalfa into his mixtures, but he'll add clovers and a lot of other things. And so he may only get a couple years of a strong alfalfa stand, but he knows that he's creating competition, and he still sees the benefit of adding that into his particular mixtures for that plane of nutrition, as well as that nitrogen benefit. You know, one of the things that we're determining now is we talk about the, I guess, the first level benefits. You know, increased yield, increased quality, improved animal performance. But we haven't really focused much on the secondary benefits. And that's where we're really seeing that discussion about sustainability and things that are coming in. And so working with producers, you know, like this guy, he's already thinking about what's happening in his soil and the pollinator environments and all of the other positive benefits. And so that's why he continues to add it, knowing he's not going to get the same performance that we're getting because we don't have as much competition in our stand. I have other producers that are learning to use it in a cutting and grazing system, and they think that that's probably going to be the best fit. And from our research, we're starting to show that maybe economically that is going to be our best use, you know, is not to have it as a singular option. You can, but maybe to maximize on that performance, you go in and you use it in multiple ways. A lot of the producers on farm, I actually have one. We let them come to us. I'm working with a producer in kind of on the Alabama-Georgia border. And I guess he's been following the alfalfa Bermuda grass trend for probably 10 years or so. And when I started 5 years ago, he told me, I want to do this. And I said, okay. And we talked every year. And then this past year, as part of one of our demonstrations, he did plant a significant amount of acreage. And what he actually did was used Roundup Ready, which is there's a Roundup Ready variety we recommend down here, as well as the dual use variety that we've been using in a lot of our evaluations in the same field. And he planted them. So now we have this awesome visual because the biggest challenge is that establishment year and the weed competition. And so I was giving him recommendations of what he can do to control. And there's, you know, you're much more limited when you don't have that Roundup technology. And you would think with Roundup Ready, why would you want that in a Bermuda grass system? Except that we induce dormancy with Roundup on Bermuda grass to plant. And so as long as you're not using the Roundup in active growth, you're not affecting your Bermuda grass. And so
you're still getting those weeds.
Exactly. And it really offers this opportunity to control the ryegrass that's going to volunteer and henbit and all of these other things that just they're short term, but they can have a big negative impact. And so I get pictures from him all the time where this is my Roundup Ready side and this is my other side. And I think it's really going to help us because he enjoys letting us know when we stay in contact with each other. But then a lot of producers respect him and his opinion. And so now he's trying it. He's actually gotten into social media and showing people like, look at this alfalfa.
Very cool.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
I like that that's, you know, an interesting use too, because again, a lot of people question, we do it a little bit up here in the Northeast too, of using Roundup Ready in these mixtures, and we use it for establishment, that establishment period, then you can interseed your grasses in. But it's so interesting to hear how you can use it in the South with existing grass that's supposed to be there next year too. You're still able to use this technology and help clean up those weeds, because we know that that's so critical, and the South has no shortage of weeds that you're dealing with. Now, are there many people growing alfalfa as a monoculture, or is it mainly going to be in mixture with these warm season grasses?
We have some top alfalfa hay producers in the state of Georgia, as well as across the Southeast, that do monoculture alfalfa and do it very well. But these guys are going to have irrigation, especially down here this far south, and they are definitely going more towards a hay market and less towards a graze. So we have a top producer that's in the northern part of the state, and he definitely is an equine hay market, and he has found that alfalfa is just the answer for everything for his system, and it works very well, and he's very good at that pure stand, I guess, establishment and production. A lot of our guys that have moved towards pure stand started with the mixture, and they have learned how to manage the alfalfa with the challenges in the Bermuda grass mixture, and then now they've stepped out and said, okay, I can do this by itself and see these other benefits. Now, we do have some dairy producers that are looking at alternative uses or how to integrate alfalfa back into their mixture. I actually visited a farm a couple weeks ago, and they just planted 110 acres, I think it was, of alfalfa, pure alfalfa, that they're going to use from a green chop standpoint to feed their dairy animals because they are a completely grass-fed dairy operation. And so it was an alternative to silage production. And so they're actually going to cut it and feed it green at that point. So it's a pure stand because you're wanting that higher quality for those dairy animals. So we don't have a lot of, I guess we don't have a lot of either, but we are seeing that it's somewhat of a transition now. And I think we've created a step in the middle there for it to be not just an all or nothing, but well, if you're not quite sure you want to go to pure stand, then why don't we work in this area and you still have something, and then you can decide if pure stand is the direction you want to go.
That makes a lot of sense. For somebody for a producer in the South that's interested in starting to transition and include alfalfa, say from a grazing transition, we already talked about the row spacing. What would be kind of your fallback grazing plan? So what should their rotation look like? Would they need to have that rotational grazing plan in place? And would they be looking at how often generally, or as a minimum, would they be looking at having to move those animals just to make sure that that alfalfa was able to regrow and thrive?
Well, so first of all, we do have a resource available, and we put, since these are multi-state projects that we're putting together, a lot of our resources we put on southeastcattleadvisor.com. And we developed a checklist, an alfalfa Bermudagrass checklist for producers, anybody that's considering this system. And it kind of starts with, here's your soil, you know, check these boxes off before you get to that system. And so they can make those informed decisions before they ever get into actually purchasing the seed and planting this. You know, this is not one of those decisions that you wake up on Saturday morning and say, hey, it's pretty outside, I'm going to go plant alfalfa. So we created a checklist. It's a downloadable thing. You can print it off, take it with you. And it's really, it's not in depth. It just tells you, here's where you need to start if you're considering alfalfa. And so it goes along with a lot of the Got Bermudagrass material and information that's out there. And then when it gets into the grazing strategies and what we've seen and what we're developing from that particular, or I guess from our data and our experience with it, you know, you're still following a lot of those trends for pure alfalfa stands, even in a mixture. And a lot of this information actually was developed in Georgia. I know that when we talk about grazing alfalfa, like, we blow people's minds, and it's hilarious to me because I'm like, that's what we do down here. You know, we cut a few things, but we graze. But we also have green material a lot of the time of the year, where most of the rest of the country just doesn't have that opportunity.
And this is another follow-up, kind of brought up another question for me. Are you seeing any differences in your stocking rates? Are you able to have a heavier stocking rate in these systems that include alfalfa compared to just the warm season grass systems? And both haylage too, are you seeing improved production with that alfalfa inclusion compared to the grasses?
Right. Yeah. So from our data, both in our baleage situation, we see you get an increase of harvest and seasonal yield if you add alfalfa into that Bermudagrass. So it's improved your quality. It improves your yield. It also increases the number of cuttings. So we'll go from 4 cuttings to potentially 7 or 8 cuttings a year, and potentially more than that. We do have some guys down here that they put it in and they cut every month once it starts. Use it for 18 to 24 months, knock it out and move on to the next thing. There's definitely an intense dairying situation where they're doing that, but you know, it fits and the numbers work out for their system. So we do see adding that alfalfa to that Bermudagrass is going to improve that quality and that yield. And in animal performance, we don't see it so much in average daily gain, but you see it in gain per acre. You consistently get to have increased stocking rate and increased stocking density, even in those hot months in the summer. And so we were consistently adding more animals when we had the alfalfa in the mixture and pulling animals off the Bermudagrass, especially in that intense drought time period. Now, we do decrease that stocking density or that stocking rate in this middle of the summer, but you can go from a higher density early in the season and later in the season with that addition. And that's pretty consistent. There's not a lot of research with alfalfa and Bermudagrass, but it is consistent with the work that Beck did out in Arkansas. And now we're seeing it. We're using a more, I guess, a tougher Bermudagrass variety, you know, that has higher quality and yield already in our system.
Well, I think that that's such an important metric too, that the pounds of gain per acre is just as important in a lot of cases as just your overall pounds of gain per animal unit. And so I think that that's important to consider too, you know, especially as we're looking at decreasing land availability and things like that, you know, that's going to play an ever increasingly important role too. So, well, Jennifer, you mentioned a couple, such as the Southeast Cattle Producers website. Where are some other locations that people can access information about your research program, extension program, and what all you guys are doing?
So I work a lot with colleagues from Auburn University and the University of Florida as well. And all three of the states have state forage webpages. So ours is georgiaforages.com. There's alabamaforages.com and Alabama Beef Systems. And so that really is where a lot of our stuff goes. On the Georgia and Alabama pages with that system, because we all do have a little bit of a beef background. A lot of our multi-state material is on southeastcattleadvisor.com, and we also have a social media presence on Facebook and Twitter with Southeast Cattle Advisor, each of the state web pages, forage pages, as well as, you know, I put a lot of stuff on my public Facebook, it's just Jennifer Johnson Tucker, and you'll see a lot of pictures from the field. And we really like to use, we use the hashtag Better Grazing, and a lot of that comes from our alfalfa Bermudagrass project that's currently going on at the Better Grazing program in Tifton.
Fantastic. And of course, you know, if you're in any of these states and you have questions, you can always Google the extension websites and directly email these guys. I'm sure they'd be more than willing to help. So, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today. This was really informative. You know, again, I love hearing about how alfalfa is used in different parts of the U.S., especially it's a little bit different from what we're used to up here. So thank you so much for joining us, and we will talk to you on the next episode of ForageCast.
Thank you, Emily. And thanks to you, our listeners. If you'd like more information about forage genetics or any of the information you heard about today, please contact your local alfalfa seed dealer or visit our website at www.foragegenetics.com. Until next time, thank you for listening. Because of factors outside forage genetics control, such as weather, soil, planting, and product application, individual results cannot be predicted or guaranteed by Forage Genetics International. Always read and follow all label instructions.